Hello, friends. This is John Zombro, and I am your host for the Lifetime Body Podcast. Welcome to the show, or welcome back. As you know, this is the place where we pursue peak performance at any age without sacrificing health or compromising longevity. It's the place where science meets common sense, and it's where we all kick ass for life. So thanks again for joining me today, episode number 45. And before we get to the subject matter of today's show, I would like to give you some special news about the latest program that's about to come out from the Lifetime Body. Over the past 20 plus years, I've had an outdoor fitness group, fitness training group that has taken on many forms. And the latest evolution of that this year is T2, and T2 stands for Training Tribe. It's basically the greatest fitness experience anyone can ever have. It's where we employ advanced scientific principles in a supportive team environment as we 10X health, fitness, and performance. This year, there are two sessions, and the first session is the one I'll tell you about today. It's going to run from May 14th through June 24th, and it is meeting twice per week on Mondays from 6 to 7:30 p.m. So obviously this portion of the message is for those people who are going to be in Southwest Montana during that time. And the first session is called Speed Camp. And Speed Camp's exciting because it's a progressive intermediate to advanced program that is focused on developing maximum speed, explosive power, and athletic agility. Speed Camp emphasizes the optimization of running technique, full body conditioning, and high levels of functional mobility. Training, education, and informal competition are blended into a fun, results-oriented atmosphere. This course is for athletes wanting to improve their sprinting and jumping abilities, and seasoned exercisers who are seeking to restore or refine their speed mechanics. It's a ton of fun, and the results are going to be spectacular. So if you'd like more information about Speed Camp, the first of the Training Tribe sessions from the Lifetime Body this year, just go to the website at thelifetimebody.com, and on the, depending on your device that you're viewing on the far right of the menu, you'll see T2, and you can get some additional information as well as register. And if you're a local listener and you have questions or just need some additional information, feel free to reach out to me personally. No problem. Love it when you do that. So thanks again. That's Speed Camp, the first part of Training Tribe. And now as we get into the topic of the day, and this is part two of Is Your Diet Working for You? This has really been a fun discussion for me to have. And as you'll recall from part one, my intention was to raise the question of individual dietary optimization, to report on some of my personal culinary explorations, and to encourage you to consider your own diet's impact on both your health and your performance. That last edition has some stories of my eating evolution, and now I want to discuss some additional topics of relevance. So if you have any questions about what I was alluding to, you can find part one of the podcast and enjoy that. The tracking and counting of macronutrients, and those are fat, protein, and carbohydrate. Micronutrients, which are vitamins, minerals, key components in our food, and calories is or can be an interesting pursuit. As part of a number of experiments and programs, I've weighed, measured, recorded, and monitored food intake with great scrutiny. This practice can be quite revealing and educational about what's in your food and how much of it you're actually eating. That stated, while there's a place for this type of behavior, and it may have distinct relationships to personality, I actually don't do this on a regular basis all the time. My feeling is that once you've eaten and logged data on a few hundred eggs or avocados, you know what they contain. It's a learning curve. Tracking can be very helpful in understanding dietary makeup, but over time, it may not be quite as necessary. Protein intake. That opens up a whole can of worms, which are very high in protein, by the way, but I don't eat worms. I've been consuming more protein over the past several years And this practice seems to enhance my recovery from exercise and the ability to build and maintain muscle mass. That's consistent with the literature. Animal-based protein is proven to be significantly more bioavailable or assimilable than plant-derived sources, and I seem to find it easier to digest. My intake definitely goes up and down, but it averages around 2.5 grams of protein per kilogram of lean body mass, or just under about 200 grams per day, since I currently weigh about 77 kilograms, which is roughly 170 pounds. Some would say this is an excessive amount of protein, or that amount is hard on the kidneys, but neither my experience nor my current research, not mine, but that of the scientific community, supports those opinions. One of the major objectives with my higher than typical protein consumption is my intention to stave off age-related sarcopenia, or the muscle loss associated with advancing chronology. I regularly perform strength training exercise, and coupled with my protein intake, the results are favorable. New research indicates that we may actually have increasing protein requirements with age. This is related to at least three factors that occur in most individuals with aging. First, we have a decreased amount and acidity, actually not as low of a pH of our stomach acid. So as we get older, we tend to produce less stomach acid, and that acid itself is essentially less acidic, and we need that to break down the proteins to get the amino acids from them. So that's the first thing. Number two, our amino acid transport and uptake mechanisms, how we get the building blocks of tissue into our cells, becomes less efficient with time. And third, older folks possessing these older muscle fibers show a tendency to have what's now known as anabolic resistance. And that's a condition in which they require a higher amount of amino acids to be present in the cell to trigger them to undergo muscle protein synthesis. So all those three strikes, if you will, against us motivate me to consume higher amounts of protein, and it seems to be working for me. With consideration to protein sources, I get my amino acids from meat, eggs, and fish, pretty much in that order. I do my best to acquire the highest quality proteins whenever possible, and terms like wild, grass-fed and grass-finished, cage-free, and many more are usually applicable. I really don't eat the vegetable protein sources like soy, rice, pea, and hemp powders in particular, and others, because they don't work as well for me. They cause various digestive issues, bloating, and the addition of unwanted things such as phytoestrogens. I've always been a big meat eater and a proponent of that practice. I personally grew up with farming and hunting, and this is a very natural position for me. Animal products in general have been shown to be the most nutrient-dense and non-inflammatory foods in the human diet. Claims that meat is somehow bad, dirty, causes cancer, rots inside you, and other claims are totally unfounded. Sure, we need to look at many environmental and ethical issues with meat production, but this same thing is true with all food products in the modern world, and that includes every plant food as well. This discussion segues nicely into one of the hottest topics in nutrition today, and that's the carnivore diet. Thousands of people are embracing an all-meat diet, maybe more, and anecdotally are reporting profound effects on health and performance. Research is just beginning to take hold on this topic, and it will certainly be ongoing. Proponents of the all-meat diet cite reduction or elimination of health, gut, joint, and skin problems, and many even promote carnivorous eating for the treatment of disease, including diabetes, cardiovascular problems, and even cancer. Here's where my experience can be described. I like meat, and I eat a lot of it. But I also enjoy a few other foods that are plant-derived, mainly cruciferous and root vegetables and berries in small to moderate amounts. I've tested eating only meat in several periods for as much as 6 weeks, but I found that my blood markers and subjective assessments were about the same as when I have my limited veggie intake. I just have to be very careful personally to avoid nightshade plants and most grains and legumes, even when those grains and legumes are fermented or pressure cooked. Your mileage may vary, of course. My meat-heavy and veggie-like platters, and some folks have told me that my diet is now a modified meatitarian. These platters are based on my instincts and my palate. However, and this is my opinion, it's not published fact, as I look at ancestral biology and anthropology, I believe the human to be a preferential carnivore and an obligate omnivore. In other words, many of us do best eating mainly animal products, but some humans appear to have a greater tolerance to some amount of plant intake and the ability to extract nutrition from it more effectively than others. I base this supposition on a very simplistic view that ancestral humans feasted heavily from one megafauna harvest to the next, and then survived the interim, foraging for whatever they could consume that carried them to the next successful hunt. In most cases, this could have potentially been seasonal plants, insects, and other sustenance. This is my interpretation of the term hunter-gatherer. I realize these statements are in discordance with the views of many vegans, but I don't mean to be offensive. I'm just reporting on what I've tested to work best for my health and performance, and hopefully longevity, as well as my opinions on human physiology and a thorough review of the available literature today. Now it's time to give fat the attention it so richly in texture, flavor, and nutritive value deserves. Based upon what I feel is an overwhelming abundance of literature, I made a concerted effort a number of years ago to eliminate the consumption of the industrial seed oils. And those are kind of like the big six that we like to call them here at TLB: canola, corn, cottonseed, safflower, soybean, and sunflower oils, which are all exceedingly high in omega-6 fatty acids, prone to oxidation, and shown to be pro-inflammatory to a great degree. Unfortunately, this is not always easily done, or in other words, avoiding these oils is not always easily done when eating away from home. Most salad dressings and sauces have a base of these oils, and practically all restaurants use them in their cooking. I can usually tell when I inadvertently get a dose of these oils, even if it's relatively small. I'll awaken the next day with, you know, really what feels like a low-grade inflammation characterized by a slight achy fatigue sensation. It's not unlike what can happen with a poor night's sleep. I'm sure I probably had this feeling for years and didn't realize it. But now that I've found out through all these dietary experiments and other health practices, I found out what feeling terrific practically every morning is like. And I really prefer that. So I do my best to avoid these so-called vegetable oils whenever possible. In my diet, as the carbs had gone down, the fats naturally went up. And some of this was integral to the meat, fish, and eggs that I was consuming. In other words, the protein source and the fat source were one and the same. However, I enjoyed the liberal use of many natural fats and have benefited from all the fat-soluble vitamins and other nutrients they contain. Lard, tallow, and coconut oil are my choices for cooking, and I like pastured butter and extra virgin olive oil as an addition to food where appropriate. What I noticed most about moderately increased fat consumption, along with the protein, was how it made my dining experience much more savory and satisfying. That fat adaptation process I mentioned in part one had amazed me for its fuel utilization effects, but what really stuck out was the regulation of my appetite. Eating more fat wiped out my cravings and stabilized blood sugar levels. Back when I was carb addicted, I'd often have those ravenous hunger episodes where eating was an emergent necessity. I haven't been hungry like that in years. Now I have these very mild, subtle indications that it might be nice to have something to eat. I love dining and I enjoy food immensely, but eating is now a much more calm and deep experience. During several measurement phases, I tracked fat consumption with respect to the type of fat, the percentage it made up of my daily calories, total grams consumed, etc. And I correlated my intake with frequent blood tests. I explored fat intake at levels from 30% of my daily calories, which is pretty low for me, to be honest, to as much as 80%, which is essentially a ketogenic diet level. Interestingly, I found that when fat comprised 50% or more of my daily caloric intake, inflammation markers tended to be at their lowest. I looked at this multiple times. I was intrigued whether this was due to lower levels of plant matter alone, and I have alluded to some of the issues with lectins and phytates and other concerns with plants before, or possibly that a threshold level of fat intake was ideal for me. So I tried to investigate that further and test this hypothesis. I periodically ate diets with varying ratios of macronutrients, and I aligned them with my blood work. What I found was that as long as fat stayed near 50% of my daily calories, so that's 50% by calories, not by volume, and carbs didn't exceed about 25%, my inflammation markers all trended lower consistently. Keep in mind, this was replicated multiple times with relatively static levels of training and sleep and other factors. I'm hesitant to report a constant macro ratio, as my diet, and probably all of ours, is indeed dynamic. But on average, I seem to do best when my dietary makeup is about 55% fat, 30% protein, and 15% carb by calories, even though I'm not really a calorie counter. These levels occasionally fluctuate in response to movement levels and seasonal eating patterns, as they should. An interesting spinoff with the dietary fat analysis was the effect on cholesterol levels. This topic can be a huge rabbit hole, or more like a cave dug by a badger for a family of elephants. And I'm going to reserve a deep dive discussion on cholesterol for other works. We've got some in the works in progress at this time. I'll tell you more about those later. When I keep my fats north of 50%, I have an average total cholesterol level that typically comes in around around 230 milligrams per deciliter. This is with HDL at around 84 and LDL about 135. Again, this is my average. Ever since I got off processed carbs, my triglycerides have been approximately around 70. So those are pretty good numbers. And when I don't eat enough, let's say I go less than 50% fat in my diet, my total cholesterol drops below 200. And the ratios of the other constituents become slightly less favorable. Where this data has meaning for me personally is with testosterone levels. Testosterone is made from cholesterol, and I tend to see normal to high levels for a guy my age when total cholesterol is near 230 or so. Dropping my dietary fat drives my cholesterol and my testosterone levels downward, and I don't feel as good. I have less energy and impaired recovery ability. Food for thought, if you allow me to say that. I've evolved my consumption of carbohydrate quite a bit over the past decade. I once viewed carbs as a staple in my diet. I think many of us did. Now they're more of a strategic tool. I used to be in the carbohydrate loading sports nutrition camp. It's what I did and it's what I preached. We were all once taught that. It was the way to go for health and performance. Carbs before, during, and after exercise were just a part of the routine. But this whole strategic tool concept stems from eating fairly low carb and being metabolically fat adapted for a number of years. Unlike essential amino and fatty acids, which we must get by consuming proteins and fats, there are really no essential carbohydrates. The body can make glucose via the process of gluconeogenesis, and the relatively small amount of glucose we need in circulation at any given time, which is about 5 grams or 1 teaspoon of glucose, can be produced by the liver from the byproducts of fat and protein metabolism. Whatever minimal quantity of ingested carbs and possibly their associated micronutrients, in effect vitamins in vegetables, that I may be needing, I seem to be getting it based on my outstanding health measures. But it's in the realm of performance where I've experimented with carb intake quite a bit. This has relationship to the type of exercise or training that I'm involved in or that anyone's involved in. And the subject of pre and post workout feeding and also the aspect of recovery are what we're going to delve into. And I'm going to apologize ahead of time. I think this next bit of information gets a little bit exercise physiology intensive, but if you bear with me, I'm going to try to make it palatable again. You know, you're with me, so you have to put up with my bad jokes. Not every expert agrees in this arena on the use of carbs in the diet for athletics. with some of the experts being quite adamant that a low carb or ketogenic diet works fine for every athlete. And if they just do it properly and adapt long enough, they can perform at any level. Others feel that the purposeful use of carbs, particularly in the, let's say, the metabolically flexible and healthy trainer, as we all should be, can be immensely beneficial. My experience kind of approximates the middle ground between these two arguments, and I've seen quite a bit of variance in this area with clients as well. The type of training which can indicate an increase in carbohydrate in the diet is what's known as glycolytic training. This is the anaerobic or high-intensity interval type training, sometimes called HIIT, and doesn't have to be interval as well. It can be, you know, hard steady state exercise, but it's the kind of training that many of us do in the pursuit of conditioning goals or in sports themselves. Glycolytic exercise burns glycogen, which is the storage form of sugar in our muscles and liver. And this can be rapidly utilized to meet energy demands. Glycogen breakdown is required when the energy demands of the session exceed what we can supply by burning body fat or dietary fat alone. So while fat-adapted and well-conditioned athletes can fuel their motion primarily with fat at a higher output level than, say, deconditioned people or sugar burners, even they will reach a point of intensity when they need to start tapping into and combusting their high-octane glycogen stores. Hopefully that made sense. These are limited depending on your body size, your muscle fiber type, and your conditioning level. But it only amounts to about 500 grams of glycogen that we store in the body on average. Here's where things get interesting. If we exercise hard enough and long enough, such as a series of 30-second to 5-minute intervals or a moderately hard, long, steady-state effort, and many other examples, we are burning up glycogen in that breathless anaerobic effort. Really easy workouts, such as a long, slow jog, don't tap into glycogen very much in the trained individual. And very intense, very brief, let's say less than 10-second bouts like short sprints or heavy lifts don't tax this system either. These rely upon what's known as the alactic or phosphagen system. It's all that moderately hard, moderately long, in relative terms, type of mojo that is so glycolytic. And the byproduct is lactic acid, which we immediately recognize as that burning, incapacitating sensation that puts a very clear limit on anaerobic performance. And I think we've all been there. If we only exercise within the limits of our glycogen storage capacity, there's no real need for consideration of supplemental carbohydrate during exercise to stave off exhaustion. But make intensity and duration significant enough to drain your glycogen tank, and all of a sudden, intra-workout carbs, often in liquid forms, can be of benefit. Going beyond 90 minutes in a run or a bike ride, or doing a high volume of reps with intervals or weights may necessitate a few carbs. I actually exercise with high intensity somewhat frequently, but I almost never extend the duration or volume to the point where I need to utilize intra-workout carbs. That's just a reflection of the training pattern that I pursue. Next, let's consider pre-workout fueling. When timed right, a small, easily digestible fuel source can temporarily make a limited amount of circulating blood glucose available to the working muscles. This has been shown to spare muscle glycogen to a slight degree, thus potentially giving the athlete an extension in time to exhaustion. I've experimented with using a 400 to 500 calorie shake about an hour before training or competition, something that was agreeable to my system and that had about 50 to 60 grams of carbohydrate in it. I do this when I was serious about putting up a number, as in trying to hit a time or a weight as a performance marker. Sometimes this seemed to help a bit. It didn't make me perform significantly better per se, but occasionally I thought it helped me to keep going a little longer or do a bit more. Much of that may have been placebo. I really don't know. However, I've gradually faded away from that practice. I'm essentially enjoying training in a fasted state most of the time and without the sensation of having anything in my stomach. I know a lot of people who swear by their pre-workout meals, however, and this is a great place to conduct your own personal experiments. Post-workout feeding is another opportunity for testing. I'll generally wait until my appetite returns after training to have a meal. If I do a long, slow, steady state workout, which is rare for me, I'm generally hungry pretty soon afterwards, and I'll chow down. But doing heavy or high intensity training tends to blunt my appetite, oftentimes for up to several hours afterwards. So my feeding window naturally extends a bit. This is where the carb content goes up and down for me. An easy workout or a brief intense one will result in me craving and eating a steak, for example. I'm not sure that's my body saying it needs to repair muscle tissue or something like that. It's just a common signal to eat a desired food. But if I do enough of that glycolytic exercise we were talking about previously, I will consistently crave carbs, and I'll usually be looking for a sweet potato or turnip with my meal. Sometimes if training is hard enough, I'll even have an increased appetite and a need for carbs the next day as well. But overall, this is rare because this pattern only seems to follow mega workouts, and I just don't do too much of those anymore in my current training patterns. Finally, this is where the subject of recovery with respect to carb intake comes into the picture. Once depleted of our emergency glycogen stores, our bodies go on a mission to replenish that fuel as quickly as possible. Studies show that athletes with carbohydrate-dependent metabolisms, which we'll call sugar burners, do indeed benefit from immediate post-event fuel intake. This window appears to be less necessary for metabolically flexible exercisers, who research indicates may actually be more efficient at glycogen synthesis. The important consideration is with frequency of glycolytic training. If an athlete needs to go long and hard, day after day, in back-to-back sessions, many, if not most authorities, will suggest that supplemental carbohydrate intake is beneficial. Having enough fuel to refill the energy stores as rapidly as metabolically possible in order to prepare for the next training session or competition can be valuable in those circumstances. For me, that last paragraph has little relevance. I love exercise, and I train in some fashion almost every day. However, I rarely extend my high-intensity workouts far enough to be massively glycogen depleting. I almost never do back-to-back hard days anymore. I seem to get better results and better health when I balance a fitness maker session with a few technique recovery and overall mobility-enhancing days. I like to train in what feels like a natural cycle, and going hard all the time not only seems unnatural from a biological perspective, it puts me into a pro-inflammatory and potentially carbohydrate-focused existence that I no longer desire or believe in. I fully recognize that everyone is different, has unique goals, and that training and eating patterns may not be the same for a 55-year-old amateur athlete as compared to a 20-something pro. I think that's enough information for this time around. I'm going to allow you to digest, couldn't resist, the reports of part 1 and 2, and I'll come back in the future with additional data and perspectives. I'd like to share some of my findings with dairy, supplements, allergic reactions, and other tests in addition to blood, which includes saliva, urine, stool, DNA, and graded exercise tests. I realize this stuff can get a little dry, like Melba toast on a saltine cracker. Melba toast or a saltine cracker on a hot day. So I'm going to give you a break, change it up a little bit. The main reason I got inspired to delve into dietary experiments was to share some personal examples and encourage you to combine the application of basic healthy eating with personalized investigations. I'll provide a quick review of what I've discovered so far and presented, and I'll flesh this out as though I'm making action statements to myself. Don't eat junk food. Eat a planet-based diet of whole, fresh, natural foods that employs the just eat real food or JERF principle. Measure and track your food intake until you really know what you're eating, what's in it, and how much of it you're consuming. Keep a journal of data to go along with your food diary and record subjective and objective information that you feel is pertinent. Use tables, spreadsheets, and graphs to your heart's content. Or not. Get lots of blood and other tests and coordinate these with your dietary experiments. Work with your healthcare providers. Find the eating pattern that gives you the most ideal health markers, the highest energy, the best body composition, the lowest inflammation, and the most joy. Eventually, try to make all this instinctive and effortless. Keep an open mind. Never stop experimenting. And recognize that your needs will invariably be dynamic as you go through life. If I summarize the message in these communications, I'd say, without wanting to seem boastful, that I'm enjoying excellent health and outstanding performance at this point in my life. I feel much of this is due to my personalized approach to nutrition, and I don't want to hog up all this excellence. I want to share it. I want you to look, feel, and perform your best also. I sincerely hope you've taken something valuable from these words. Let me know what you think, and please share your comments and questions. And thanks for listening today. Have a great one.